Do you remember reading Crockett Johnson's Harold and the Purple Crayon?
So, Lisa, that is my favorite children's book.
That's Brian Pinkney. He's the author and illustrator behind Time for Kenny, Brandon and the Baby, Hey Otter, Hey Beaver, and others. He's cited Harold as his favorite book he didn't illustrate.
I think as a kid reading it and having just a vivid imagination, and again, I drew all the time. So this idea that this book is making magic with a crayon, and that's it, was amazing for me.
To his family and friends, Crockett was Dave Lisk. You might know him best for the bold purple line that gives shape to the spare illustrations of Harold and the Purple Crayon.
I think as the years went on, just thinking about Crockett creating that and keeping it simple, you know, and choosing not to make a lot of colors and just having it be about that line makes it special to me.
Today, we're tracing that line all the way back to Harold's publication in 1955. I'm Lisa DeSaro, and this is Remember Reading.
So looking back, I mean, I think it was a slightly unconventional book when it was published. It was somewhat more sophisticated book conceptually than most children's books. That wasn't an observation I could make when I was six. I can now.
You might remember Chris Van Allsburg from our last episode. He's the author and illustrator of Bad Day at Riverbend, Jumanji, The Polar Express, and more.
But the concept behind Harold and the Purple Crayon, so simple, something so easily grasped by a child, and yet so fruitful in terms of the kind of narrative opportunities, the story you could tell, having embraced this simple, magical idea of a crayon that could be used to create the world that Harold moved through. So stuck with me all these years. So when I, you know, I was an adult and I became a book illustrator and writer, and people asked, oh, what was your favorite book when you were a kid? First one that came to mind, Harold and the Purple Crayon.
He's searched his memory for his other favorites. But over the years, Crockett Johnson's illustrations are still the clearest in his mind. The book begins with a scribble of purple, and on the next page, Harold, and not much else. He's in his all-white pajamas, holding his big purple crayon, still attached to the purple line from the page before. The rest of the page is white, except the text.
One evening, after thinking it over for some time, Harold decided to go for a walk in the moonlight.
Harold looks up at the empty corner of the page where perhaps a moon should be. Soon, he draws the moon. Then a sidewalk to walk on.
He made a long, straight path so he wouldn't get lost. And he set off on his walk, taking his big purple crayon with him.
The peculiar little book, no bigger than a sizable jacket pocket, follows Harold's walk through his self-made landscape. For many, the book stands as a portrait of a young artist. Some even think that the child drawn to the book is destined to become an artist too. For Chris, not so much.
You know, old people go, well, of course. You grew up to be an artist. And of course, there is an early sign that you were going to be one. At 6 o'clock, you were so attracted to the empowerment that comes to an artist through the crayon or the brush or the pencil that they hold. Already at the age of six, you knew this about yourself. Of course, that's baloney.
Or is it?
So as a young person, I always knew I was an artist.
Brian had no shortage of artistic influence in his youth. His father, Jerry Pinkney, was also an author and illustrator after all.
I spent a lot of time in my father's studio watching him make pictures and see him explore, try different things. He often used me and my siblings as models for his books. So we saw the creative process up close. We were part of it.
Chris's beginning as an artist was less confident. In his words, he conned his way into art school at the University of Michigan. He had little experience making art in high school before that. So he was out of his element. Over his head, he says.
I thought that all the drawing skills that I saw around me were people who were born with a natural gift and that they were born that way. And based on my own drawing skills at the time, I clearly wasn't born that way. So I decided I would look for something else to do that didn't make me feel like such a kind of loser.
Maybe Chris didn't see himself as Harold the Young Artist. But later, he would go on to write and illustrate a story not unlike Crockett's. He wasn't thinking of Harold, though, not at first.
It's called Bad Day at River Bend. It's actually a cowboy story or a Western. And I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about other ideas. Of course, when I got done and when I reflected on it, I saw a similarity because they're both about the power yielded by a small child of the crayon.
Bad Day at Riverbend follows a community in the style of a coloring book. We follow the characters as they're plagued by a mysterious force they've never encountered before. It's the crayon Chris mentioned. I asked Chris how he came up with the idea for the book. It started with a coloring book that lay open on his daughter Sophia's bedroom floor.
It was a Peter Pan coloring book, and it had a picture of Princess Tiger Lily. And at this point in the story, Princess Tiger Lily had fallen into a pond of water. And she had an alarmed expression on her face because she was drowning. Or she thought she was going to drown. Of course, she didn't because Peter saved her. But that picture, my daughter had been inspired to color. And she just taken crayons and kind of randomly colored over Tiger Lily's face with yellow, green, purple marks all across her face. She still, of course, had this alarmed expression. And when I looked at it, it occurred to me that this person in the coloring book was reacting to what had happened to them. Namely, that they had this alarmed, terrified expression on their face because what Sophia had done to them with the crayons.
The cover of Bad Day at Riverbend looks a lot like that alarmed Tiger Lily, but instead of the Peter Pan character, we see a cowboy sheriff type in bold black outline. It seems no one has colored him in yet. His face is one of horror as he looks up at the colorful squiggles of waxy crayon encroaching around him.
So I took that idea and I thought, well, what if there was a reality which is exists within the pages of a coloring book, and the characters don't know they're in a coloring book because the book has not been opened yet and used by a child.
The opening pages show no indication of a child beyond the quiet little town. If not for the text on the page, you might not even know it wasn't just a coloring book. Riverbend, the book says, is the kind of place where no one comes. And no one leaves. And every day is just the same.
And so they're accustomed to the lives they live there. It's a boring, routine life. But then one day something happens. And what happens is that the coloring book is finally discovered by a child. The child goes to work. And so the characters in the coloring book have to contend with what's happening to their world. And it's traumatic for them. It's really bad news.
When a stagecoach arrives in town, it's already strange. No one has seen a stagecoach come to Riverbend before. What's more alarming is that there's no coachman in sight, and stuck to the coach's horses are greasy, chestnut-colored stripes and loops of slime. Our sheriff, Ned Hardy, even tries to pull the stuff off the horses, but the haphazard loops of crayon stick to them. The style is a departure from Chris's other numerous titles. You might recognize his work in the style of The Polar Express, with its rich, deep palette, or Jumanji, with its more delicate grayscale. Bad Day at Riverbend and all its scribbles of color presented a bit of a challenge.
I found that I could not make them quite as chaotic as they needed to be, so I actually got Sophia's coloring books and used them as reference material. So I could have the appropriate kind of strange marks that flew all over the place. But even that was fun, you know, creating these kind of wild abstract marks on top of the cowboys.
When the sheriff finds him, the missing coachman's face is colored exactly how you might expect a six-year-old to do it. And he's not happy about it. Stripes of blue and red cover his eyes and lips. Back in town, other afflicted townsfolk tell Sheriff Hardy how their condition came to be. A light filled the sky, and everything froze, they tell him. When the light passed, they were newly colored in. It's almost as if there's been an alien invasion, or at least, a child invasion. Meanwhile, in Harold's blank slate world, other chaos threatens his existence. But the threat isn't a crayon. The threat isn't a thing, really. It's an absence of something. Of anything. Harold is looking for home. If he could find a mountaintop, he could get a handle on his surroundings. So he draws one.
He was getting tired, and he felt he ought to be getting to bed. He hoped he could see his bedroom window from the top of the mountain, but as he looked down the other side, he slipped. And there wasn't any other side of the mountain. He was falling, in thin air. But luckily, he kept his wits and his purple crayon.
This is one of Brian's favorite moments in the book.
Well, one of my favorites is when he's falling, and in midair, he's looking kind of chill and cool. He just draws, which you don't know what it is at first, and he's descending quickly, but he makes a hot air balloon. And this idea that, yeah, like you can create magic in any moment. Even sometimes when things seem like it's perilous, you can still, you know, use your imagination to come with a solution.
The possibility of magic at any moment is a theme common to Brian's work. In his newest book, Brandon and the Baby, he explores the magic of another ordinary object, a blanket.
Okay, so Brandon and the Baby, I first heard a story from a friend of mine whose nephew had a sheet that would turn into different things. He called it Batty, and I thought that would be a good idea for a book. And a couple years later, he had a baby brother born. And I remember a story about how the baby brother was reaching for that object.
That's what happens in Brandon and the Baby. Older brother Brandon has a favorite blanket, but he isn't prepared to share it with a new baby brother. In fact, he isn't so sure he wants anything to do with this new baby at all. At some point in the writing process, Brian realized this was actually his own story.
My brother came about 18 months after me. And I can't remember that far back, but I can remember far back enough to know that, you know, there was sibling rivalry going on there and how I could sense that feeling, you know, and how could I put that into a book?
In the story, Brandon misses being the baby of the family. He doesn't want to sit in his big kid chair. He doesn't want to bathe in the big tub. But every time Brandon gets upset, his blanket has a better idea. In one scene, his blanket transforms into a toucan. In another, a sea lion. The transformation of each bothersome task into a joyful moment eases Brandon's misgivings about being a big brother. And when the baby gets his own blanket, he knows just how to use it. Across Brian's books, play is a dominant theme, which makes sense, since play is how Brian works. In Hey Otter, Hey Beaver, he explores how two friends approach play differently.
That one started out definitely about me and Andrea. And on several notes, Andrea, she works. When I work, I play. I think her work is play, but she definitely has a more disciplined way of working than I do, and more regimented, I would say. It's also what happens when we get in a body of water.
Brian's wife, Andrea, does laps, while Brian is a little more interested in doing somersaults and underwater dancing. In the book, while Beaver wants to build a dam, Otter wants to play with sticks. You can probably guess who's who. But what's particularly striking in Brian's work is its emphasis on movement. Sprightly brush strokes around every step, dip, and flip of the characters create a sense of constant motion.
Well, you know, you talk about movement, and movement's very important to me. And I had an instructor when I was in college said, there's always this wind around my art.
His instructor was right. Swooshes of blue and green create the rolling, watery landscape, while broad elliptical yellows make a sunny sky.
You know, and it's almost like I think of it as like the aura, like things have an aura that I either see or sense. And I feel like that informs that energy that you see around them and that movement.
His painting process is one that leaves room for surprise. Like Harold, Brian tends to discover his world as he makes it.
And sometimes I'll paint things before I know what they're going to be. And I don't see it until it's already painted. And then I can make, you know, changes. And that's when the play begins. Because then I'm playing around with the shapes that I made. And then story gets involved. And so I just keep playing.
Even the language of the book revels in experimentation. It reads like a song. That's not too surprising, given Brian's background as a musician.
So sometimes I heard it as a narrative. Sometimes I heard it as a song. I even think I heard it as a rap at one moment. And so it's like I just write it down literally on my iPhone. That's how I write. And I had, you know, like 18 different versions of it. And then I would print it out and then move them around and say, which lines do I like from which version? What goes with what artwork?
Chris's development as an artist demanded a certain amount of play, too. Having studied as a sculptor in school, the two-dimensional space was a little more foreign to him. So he mastered pencil and charcoal, and then it was time to explore new territory.
I got to a point, and I did, with some trepidation, sort of arrive at this point where I said, well, you know, I've done these black and white books. Maybe I should, since, you know, the technology exists to reproduce color. I should try a color book. So I did. I should emphasize that whenever I was doing these things, I was doing them as an autodidact. I didn't know anything about them. And what I would do is I would just go to art stores and get a bag and I'd fill it up with a bunch of stuff and then I'd bring it home and play around with it. I should have just gone back to school and taken some courses and learned how to watercolor, learn how to use pastels, learn how to use these different materials. But I don't know. I thought I would have more fun just poking around in my studio and experimenting.
Of course, that hands-on experimentation is probably how we ended up with books like The Polar Express, The Stranger, and Bad Day at Riverbend. Sure, a formal education is a significant help, but that experimentation is a fundamental element of any artist's growth, and for Chris as much as Brian. Brian certainly had an added benefit of his father as a kind of live-in mentor. Now, he returns the favor to budding artists.
I taught art for a while in Harlem at a place called the Arts Carnival, and it was fascinating to see that the young artists were not only interested in how I taught them art, but me as a person, and that I valued what they were making.
Even great artists need validation, especially from other experienced artists. Crockett Johnson and his wife Ruth Krauss were known for their mentorship too, and they had one particularly famous protege known for his peculiar style. Maurice Sendak was a young man when Ruth and Crockett took him on as a mentee. Brian's work at the Arts Carnival follows in a long tradition of artists mentoring, motivating, and celebrating a younger generation's work. Brian remembers one student whose approach to the class stood out to him.
He was about 8 years old. And he loved my painting class. And he would just soak up everything I said. But he didn't paint. And then he'd show me things he did in other people's classes. And I was like, wait a minute, why aren't you painting that in my class? And he had this little smirk on his face, like he couldn't even say it. But I saw what it was. He was soaking up all this information from me and then applying it outside.
That 8-year-old boy reminded Brian of his own experience as an art student.
It just reminds me of a story when I was getting my master's degree where we had an instructor who had us go out in Central Park and we were like painting, you know, making art in our sketchbooks. And I remember hanging out with my friends and we rented a rowboat and we're eating pretzels and we left the park, hadn't done anything. We ran into my instructor and he's like, we didn't do anything. He said, that's okay. It's all up in your head. Now when you go back to your studio, you'll make artwork.
That turned out to be good advice for Brian, and maybe for that little boy too. He suggests fostering the young artist maybe less about insisting on certain techniques or giving critical feedback on the quality of the work, and more about bearing witness.
So, knowing that you have someone who can watch you grow, like my dad watched me, not so much even giving them constructive criticism, but just being there and witnessing them creating and validating them for that, I think is important.
For Chris, he finds some of his books offer themselves as prompts for young readers to make their own stories. Sometimes he gets to see the results.
The book that's generated, I don't know the most volume in terms of individual letters, but the most volume in terms of page count is The Mysteries of Harris Burdick, because teachers will use the Mysteries of Harris Burdick as a story prompt. And I've read a lot of Harris Burdick stories over the years, and some of those are really strange.
The Mysteries of Harris Burdick is a book every bit as mysterious as the eerie black and white images that fill its pages. The book showcases the work of an artist who, for the purposes of anyone who wished to find him, vanished. Chris tells the story of Mr. Burdick in the introduction to the book. It goes like this. Chris encountered Burdick's work through a mutual publisher at the time, Peter Wenders. Burdick had shown Wenders 14 illustrations, each with a caption to suggest the possibility of a story. In one image, titled The Seven Chairs, a nun sits on a chair floating high above two priestly figures. The caption is brief. It says, quote, "The fifth one ended up in France," unquote. In another illustration, Mr. Linden's library, a girl sleeps with an open book at her side, vines growing from its pages. The text beneath it reads, quote, "He had warned her about the book. Now it was too late," unquote. Burdick told Wenders that there were stories to go with each, but Wenders never got to read them. Nor did he ever find Mr. Burdick again, though he tried. Now, those illustrations, with their language as spare as Crockett Johnson's images, offer a source of endless potential to the youngest of artists. They're the ones, Chris says, with the best material.
The youngest ones who are encouraged to do this in their classroom, and I think that could be like maybe fourth grade, they're still limited in terms of their vocabulary, but they still have stories they want to tell. and they tell them anyway, even with this limited vocabulary. And I find that the younger authors have more original ideas.
Likewise, the play that makes art happen can demand that artists see the world a bit like children. Maybe that explains his daughter's hand in Riverbend's making. Back in town, the sheriff and his friends come to a frozen halt. The photorealistic hand of a child casts a shadow on the page, guiding a waxy, deep red crayon across one of the horses. And so the fate of Riverbend is determined by the whims of a child playing. As for Harold, he still has plans.
So Harold has been sort of on the radar of the film industry, filmmakers, for a while. I remember 20 years ago, my friend Maurice Sendak controlled the option to make Harold into a film.
We unfortunately never saw Maurice's Harold, but now we have a new opportunity to see Harold in theaters.
I know that he let that option lapse, or I didn't exercise the option, it lapsed. And I'm sure that since then, other filmmakers have probably, you know, optioned it, put some screenwriters on it, couldn't find a way to, as they say in the business, crack the story. And what that means is that you have a piece of intellectual property that seems as if it could be the basis for a successful film story, but it's not clear how that could be accomplished.
Filmmakers have finally cracked it, and they're bringing Harold to the silver screen, live action style. And Brian is excited to find out just how it might be reimagined.
So I love it when books become movies, because I love seeing how a different format and a different eye and a different creative process will envision something. I personally try not to compare it to my experience of Harold and the Purple Crayon, because I know that that is my experience. So I will separate that out and look at it more as like, be curious to see, you know, how it is interpreted through someone else's eyes in a different format.
In the meantime, Harold is finding his way home, but not without a bit of searching. A mountain's climb, an impromptu hot air balloon ride, and many pies after his walk begins, Harold is a bit tired. Now, if he could just find his bedroom window. Then, he remembers.
He remembered where his bedroom window was, when there was a moon. It was always right around the moon. And then Harold made his bed, he got in it, and he drew up the covers. The purple crayon dropped on the floor, and Harold dropped off to sleep.
In 2005, Maurice Sendak told Jennifer Ludden of his particular love for Harold. That to him, Harold isn't about a lesson. Maybe it isn't about anything at all. He said to Ludden, quote, "Harold is just immense fun. That's all, just fun. But also, Harold does exactly as he pleases. There are no adults to demonstrate or remonstrate." Unquote. I asked Brian if he agrees with Maurice. Are there lessons to be learned from Harold?
You know, I would agree with that, that there are no lessons. Yet, for a child, there's guidance. And as a child, I didn't think about my parents. They gave me a lot of freedom. And being that my dad was an illustrator also, and my mom kind of understood that, I had a lot of freedom to play and wander, either with art supplies or even outside our backyard. So the idea of there being no parents supervising him feels natural to me. And I think also in a child's head, there hopefully are no parents if parents have figured out a way to not put their voice inside their kid's head too much. So I definitely agree with what he says there.
Chris has another idea about what Harold and Riverbend might offer young readers.
When I finished it and I was encouraged to write some flap and promotional material, I think the conclusion I came to, and it might overlap slightly with Harold, but it was the idea that in our lives that fate is fickle. Fate can be as fickle as a six-year-old with a yellow crayon.
Riverbend and its sheriff may have seen the end of their Western adventure. Harold, on the other hand, continues exploring in Harold's fairy tale, Harold's trip to the sky, Harold at the North Pole, and more. I asked Brian what kind of adventure he would have Harold go on if given the chance.
You know, that's an interesting question because I thought of it. I was like, wait, maybe that's my next book. And I was thinking, what could he do that he didn't do in that book? And one thing I would think is he didn't have relationships at all. Like he didn't meet a friend or a puppy. So that may be a way that I would approach it.
It might look a little bit different too.
It's going to have a bunch of swooshes. Instead of having a crayon, he's going to have a brush, probably.
Hopefully someday we'll get Harold and the Purple Paintbrush. Until then, Harold and his purple crayon have other adventures in store for us. Whether to the circus, the sky, or even a nice day at the movies, a little bit of exploration and play might just take us all the way there. For now, playtime is over, but just for the night. until tomorrow. This episode of Remember Reading is produced by my colleagues at HarperCollins, Nellie Kurtzman, Colleen O'Connell, Elba Luz, Nancy Antelli, and Bethany Vinatero. And special thanks to Podfly for their production support. I'm Lisa DeSaro. Thanks for listening.